Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us again for another one of our fine episodes here. Of course, what makes it fine is my co-host, Sam Bradley. And Sam, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good out here in Colorado. It's not quite winter yet, but the weather did kind of get chilly. So I think we're heading into a new weather pattern, and the guy who can tell us best about that is Kyle. Is a little wobbly on his audio tonight. He's driving, but hi, Kyle. Tell us what's going on.
Hello, everyone out there in Disaster Podcast Land. Meteorologist Kyle Nelson coming to you from the less than snowy central mountains of Colorado, as opposed to the more snowy northern mountains of Colorado. Not that I'm bitter about it or anything, but hey, ski season's just getting started here in the mountains. Looking back at our active week of hazardous weather across the U.S., we had a winter storm system move in this past weekend over the Pacific Northwest, track quickly to the south and east over the central Rockies, bringing heavy mountain snows for those areas that were favored by west and northwest flow. That system then moved on to the eastern U.S., where it's bringing some more seasonable temperatures for this time of year. So definitely dropping those high temperatures down into the 20s and the 30s for some folks, and also cranking up the lake effect snow machine in the Great Lakes region. Looking ahead now at the forecast for across the U.S., high and dry is the name of the game for at least the next week across the western half of the United States. And that's going to be bringing us fair weather, calm, clear skies. And that's not the forecast that we want to hear, especially from my friends in California that are dealing with those active wildfires. Also, look for air quality alerts to start popping up over those mountain valleys in the western United States as the cold air settles in overnight. And that cold air then will become trapped in those mountain valleys until we can get some active weather to mix that all those particles and things out. So if you or someone that you know, or you have a large population in your area of responsibility that is affected by poor air quality, definitely be on the lookout for those alerts to be issued. For my friends in the eastern half of the U.S., below normal temperatures and more seasonable winter weather type feel is on the docket for you for the next week or so until we can hopefully get a pattern change. That's all we have for the disaster weather roundup. Back to you guys.
So, Jamie, we got Dr. Joe with us tonight again. How are things down there in Memphis, Joe?
Hey, guys. Well, we're beginning to get a little bit of winter weather. It's going to be quite cold tonight and down in the 20s and by the end of the week. So we got a little cold blast coming our way.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of cold here on the East Coast, too. Going to be down in the teens at night for the next week or so.
Well, in here as well. So I think Kyle would be telling us that, were he here, that the whole nation seems to be taking a southward trend. Our guest tonight is Sarah Hathaway, and she is from California, I believe. So how are things out west weather-wise, Sarah?
So we just had a low pressure system move out. It was really, really, really windy, which is unusual for us yesterday. But we have a high pressure system that's going to come in and just sit here for a couple weeks. So we're looking at 60s, mid 60s to high 60s. And, you know, it's real rough for us in California.
You're not near any of the fires, the wildfires that had gone on last week.
No, sir. You know, Southern California just lit up again. That was the wind that we had yesterday. The Santa Ana winds came in and just lit up Southern California again last night. So, yeah, say some prayers for those folks down there. But Northern California, we're nice and wet. We had some good rain come through already this year. Got some snow up in Tahoe. So, you know, it's looking really good. And it's the best time of year. Everything turns green out here instead of brown. So,
yeah, for the very short duration. I moved from California 2 years ago, and all I remember is everything being brown. But, you know, it's kind of a surprise when we have, I remember 2007, we had the big fires in San Diego area. But to see that in December is kind of scary. And speaking of scary things, you write about scary things, and you're an author. You've written Yes, you do. And you've written, at least in your one series, you've written four books, which kind of go from the initial book into the, you know, what happens to this character throughout. Four books, I believe. And I guess you, as I understand it, you did a lot of research for the first book called Day After Disaster. And, I assume it's just kind of basically one of those things where it's fine, then there's this huge earthquake and everything's not fine. And this one character has to figure out how to negotiate without all the things she's used to having. So you want to tell us a little bit about that book?
Yeah. Absolutely. So my series is the Changing Earth series, and it starts out with the after disaster. It's based on a worldwide earthquake. So this is continental plate shifting and, the polar caps melting and things like that. So when she starts out, my character Erica has no idea that things are that, you know, that it's that worldwide. She's in the disaster. She's alone. She doesn't know if her family survived or not. And the first book is her, you know, her journey to find out, did my family survive this catastrophe? And then it goes from there into book two, which is Without Land. And it's basically my ode to big government, how the government kind of decided to handle this catastrophe and what to do with all the refugees and how they got sucked kind of into that system. And then, book three, things went down in Without Land that sent them on the run from the federal forces, from everybody. And they decide that they're just going to take off and kind of claim their own freedom. And so that goes rather interestingly. She ends up being melded back in, and that brings us into my current book, which I just released, which is Battle for the South. And, they know from scientists that more disaster is on the way, that the Great Quake wasn't the end of it all. It was the beginning of it all. And so they're trying to save their friends and family because the government, you know, their resources are tapped and they just can't help people anymore. So when disaster strikes, they just handle the aftermath instead of trying to go in and actually save people. So, you know, it's an interesting concept, and I really wanted to do, like, start with the disaster and go from what the people had to do to adjust to this changing planet. So that's really the focus is, our planet, and that it is alive, it will change, it has in the past, and it will so again in the future.
Well, interestingly, Dr. Joe is a USAR doc, so he's one of those guys that does go out there and tries to help people. And I'm also a federal employee working on a federal disaster medical assistance team, so we're those guys. But, you know, we always have to wonder, too. And I'll be honest, this last year was a really good test of the system because with the back-to-back hurricanes, Joe was deployed three times. I was deployed three times. That's just unheard of. Each of these disasters.
And then with fires lighting up, different.
Oh, yeah.
If it just got hit time after time after time, there's going to come a point where if it hit the whole nation at once, you'd have to kind of go, well, it's triage, right? You'd have to decide who
is, scale. Yeah.
Right? Yeah, who's savable and who's not, basically. And that's kind of the premise for my book, and then what it's like to be an individual kind of caught in the middle.
Yeah. Well, I know you did a lot of research on this premise, which was this really large earthquake. How realistic is something like that? And I can see where one thing would lead into another, and I want to get Joe's take on this, where the earthquake could, bring up magma or something and then start affecting the polar cap. I mean, I can see the series of events unfolding, but, what did you find in your research in terms of how realistic this kind of scenario might be?
So it'd have to be something massive, like it'd have to be a continental plate shifting, like on a huge scale. So enough that, our magma core, had some kind of a shift in it that affected all the plates above it. So, it's really, it would have to be huge planet change, basically changing from Pangea into the world as we know it now kind of episode for that to happen. So it is, a little bit out there, but it was a great way to show like the ocean level increase and things like that because the earthquake started shaking those continents as well, which caused more of the ice to fall in. And that would affect our whole, all our weather patterns and everything that goes on across the globe. So so as far as like having the worldwide earthquake, it would have to be a major planetary change. And, we've seen them in the past. And so it was kind of my reminder of like, we have been so fortunate as human beings to live on a stable planet as long as we have. And for us to think that that would never change into the future, I just don't think that's a realistic view at all, you know.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I saw something somewhere today as I was reading, and it said something about the polar ice caps and how that may cause California to continue to be in drought. And I'm not sure how that works. That was a question I was going to pose to Kyle when we get a chance, because that doesn't seem, one doesn't seem to work with the other. I don't know, Joe, what do you think?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that specific weather-related question, but I am actually, I'm really fascinated by sort of getting some information about how and where and what kind of things, I hate not to be any more specific than that, that you learned about disaster response and sort of taking care of yourself and all that sort of stuff in, you know, this obviously apocalyptic kind of scenario. I'd just be really interested to hear some of the common themes that you found as you were researching it, and sort of what things struck you as stuff that regular people, quote unquote, probably haven't thought about or don't know.
So my take on prepper and survivalism is to know what's available around you. So, you know, whatever you stock, it's going to run out. Whatever you do, you know, whatever you try and save from this world into that one is going to run out. So you need to know what's available in nature, and not only what's available around you, but the ecosystems change so rapidly. So if you had to go on the move, you have to know what's available in those other ecosystems as well, how you can test those things. One of the biggest... go ahead.
No, go ahead, Sarah.
So one of the biggest awakenings that I had, along this process was, you know, I was thinking me, myself, my family. And that is not realistic. Like, that's not a realistic view at all. Like, the lone wolf attitude of it's going to be me against the world, that is not reality. You're going to need a community. That's the only way that you're going to survive, basically, is if you can pad yourself with a community of like-minded people. So that's, you know, that's been my kind of personal awakening, is that we need to awaken our communities too. We need to have prepared communities in order to survive any kind of event that would hit our nation at the same time. And, you know, we've seen that in the disaster areas. You know, if you had really prepared communities all surrounding the area that got hit, you can just send in rapid relief then, because everybody's ready to go. But everybody, you know, a fair amount of our population wants to hide their head in the sand and pretend like it's never going to happen to them. But the truth is, it could happen at any time. And why don't we just be ready so we could go help each other?
That makes perfect sense. And we've talked about that. And, you know, I think there is probably a lot higher level of awareness, being that we've had so many natural disasters just on a smaller scale, that people are really starting to think, oh, wow, and this can include active shooter and all the other things going on out there. It's like, okay, well, maybe this stuff could touch my life. So maybe I better think about this. Because the other thought I had when you were talking about that is, if people know what to do, they're going to do something positive. They're going to do something, you know, that makes sense. If people don't know what to do, they're going to run around and look for somebody else to fix it for them. And then it creates a bigger problem. What are your thoughts, Jamie?
Well, I completely agree. I think, you know, it's about community preparedness and resilience in the face of these things. And we're actually seeing that play out in places like Puerto Rico right now, where they're really strapped for the amount of resilience they have long term. Now, you know, this is that's an extreme situation where you're looking at months and months. Still, people have, you know, 50% of the island is still without power. You know, that's a significant event, but I think it's a good example in a localized setting of what could happen, you know, in a broader setting in something like Sarah depicts.
Yeah, and you know, that's really why I wrote Day After Disaster to begin with. I didn't want to focus so much on, like, what the disaster was, because it doesn't really even matter what the disaster was. It's how do you respond to it? What's going to, you know, how, what's happening? So I wanted the reader to be able to really take themselves and put themselves into that shoe and go, what would I do if I was in that situation? Wow. You know, I need to start doing some research. I need to start educating myself. And that was, you know, my first book was all about just trying to get the reader into that position, trying to get them into that mindset where they would think, oh my gosh, you know, this is all so fragile. Everything that we depend on, everything we take for granted is so fragile. And tomorrow it could be gone. And what am I going to do?
You know, that brings up an idea. You guys were teasing me earlier about being a dinosaur, which is actually true. But you know what?
Yep.
If it hits the fan, the dinosaur has skills predating, you know, cell phones, the internet, and all of that, that I could revert. You know, we talk about that in terms of EMS, Joe, where I could still write a paper PCR, which isn't done very much anymore. But can you imagine most of today's EMS people having to take out a pen and a piece of paper and write down patient care information? I mean, that's just unheard of. So I think, to be honest, those of us that are older would probably adapt a little bit better to something like that than people that are so, what Sarah's alluding to, that are just so tied to social media and electronic things and the internet and so forth. What do you think about that?
Well, I'd agree with you. I mean, just look what happens in, you know, a hospital when the power goes out and, you know, all of our electronic technological aids, and I use that word in quotes because sometimes they're not. You know, we have to revert to paper to order our labs, and we have to write notes by hand, and, you know, can't put orders in the computer and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, it's a huge step back in many ways, but certainly it's a skill set that we don't use often enough. And I think that, you know, those are good lessons to be learned from the standpoint of being able to take care of yourself, is that you need to be able to kind of go back to the days before all the stuff that's not going to work is not going to work, cell phones and, you know, et cetera. And you know, we're so dependent on those things now that a lot of folks would be very dysfunctional without them.
Well, would you also agree, and I'm thinking really about the hurricanes and all the hospitals in Florida that were affected. In fact, I saw something today about one that is just too badly damaged to even be repaired and come back online, that they're rethinking their disaster plans to these more serious events that, you know, maybe more so than they did in the past when they looked at disaster preparedness.
I think that's true. I think we're seeing that these things can build on top of each other, and that in more and more cases, the scales of sort of man-made related issues, terrorism and things like that, are getting larger and larger all the time, so that, you know, they truly are approaching disaster level proportions now, when in the past that was, at least a smaller scale event, but not so much anymore.
Well, and you look back at Katrina, and the entire healthcare infrastructure just disappeared. And we've had many conversations with people about that. What are your thoughts on that, Jamie? That, you know, and I want to throw this back at Sarah about, you know, if there is no healthcare infrastructure anywhere, what are the kind of things you do to take care of yourself? So, Jamie, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we had this conversation with Gustavo Flores, talking about what kind of things he ran into immediately after the hurricane passed in Puerto Rico, and some of the things that, you know, they ran into. And he's a physician, and, you know, there was just no way he could take care of some of the people that, you know, there was a cardiac arrest. They didn't have any way to transport them. So that's a person that's not going to survive, right? I mean, you know, when the infrastructure fails in a big way, things start happening immediately that are as a cascading events as a result of that. And you know, they got a call for a cardiac arrest an hour after the hurricane had passed through. They couldn't get an ambulance out. That person had to be, unfortunately, for lack of a better term, written off, because there was no way to revive them once they couldn't get resources there.
That's the unfortunate side of triage, as Sarah was alluding to. That's just triage on a much more massive scale. So Sarah, when you were thinking in terms of your character, Erica, and what she's going through with the world, you know, falling down around her, were there issues with healthcare and your people that were injured? Did she engage in any of that? How did you treat that piece of it?
Right. So I have a lot of those issues that come up on, you know, in the show, in my books, a lot of medical issues that come up. So I lean a lot towards learning what is available in nature again. So both for food, but also for healing. Now, of course, you know, you're going to be hard pressed to be able to take care of a heart attack with any kind of herbal treatment. It's not going to happen. You know, you can't repair. Right. Not. Right. You can't repair a shattered shoulder with, you know, from a bullet wound with herbs. You know, the best you can do is, you know, try to just minimize what the future impact of that is going to be. Now, there's great ways to make sure that you're not going to be that person in cardiac arrest when that disaster hits. And that's probably your best bet, is to be physically fit now, to, you know, be taking care of your heart, to know what herbs will help you with health heart and help moderate your high blood pressure and stuff like that now while we have all our soft, comfy things. You know, you know how to step away from those medicines if something happens, because if something happens, we're going to lose a huge portion of the population just because they don't have access to their pharmaceutical drugs.
Oh, yeah. Joe and I see that on virtually every disaster. You know, the piece about being fit makes sense.
Right.
You don't think about that long term. So what are your thoughts on that, Joe?
Oh, I think there's no question that's a huge preventative thing, whether it's in response and preparation for a disaster or just living longer in general. So, you know, I certainly do agree that those things necessarily need to be focused on. And I think it's fascinating to sort of look at the interaction between that more homeopathic style of medicine versus, you know, what things are we doing with our pharmacopoeia and others that are, you know, supposedly work, but if you lose a bunch of weight, you really don't need the diabetic medicines anymore, and you don't need the hypertensive medicines anymore. So, you know, there's definitely something on both sides of that fence.
Yeah, that's a good lesson there. Jamie, you had a thought.
Well, we actually talked about this in a past episode we did at the Preparedness Summit, where we did some interviews, or I did an interview with some folks that talked about resilient communities from health departments around the country. And they were talking about the fact that healthier communities, healthier areas of the country where people were more fit and more health conscious, tended to do better when natural disasters strike, just because they were able to ride out some of these things. They didn't have as many people that were dealing with chronic illnesses and things like that that needed constant refrigeration for medications and things like that. And you look at areas like Colorado and other parts of the country that are more fit because they've made an initiative at the state level or even the local level in some places to have a more fit community, it plays in their favor when things go bad.
Very good point. So Sarah, you know, kind of on that note, how do, you know, people look at your books and go, yeah, this is a neat work of fiction. It's never going to happen. None of this is ever going to happen to me. How do we convince communities, you know, starting with individuals, but communities that, yeah, this can happen, whether it's just a tornado, an earthquake, a fire, whatever it may be, you can be, it can and will be affected by it. And we're not talking, you know, about the, well, like in the disaster scenarios Joe and I work, people come in because they don't have their meds, but we're able to find those. In this scenario, there won't be any, you know,
right,
just what you
right
guys were talking about. So you're going to have to just deal with whatever your medical condition is when you don't have those meds. But how do we convince communities they really need to get serious about this?
That is a great question. And if you figure it out, no, I'm kidding. It really is a great question. It's how to get people on board. And so that's really what I'm working on with my podcast, with my books. I try to make my books very family focused and, you know, not so far out there that you would be like, man, I just can't relate to these characters at all. Just like real everyday people that are existing. And you can read the story from, you know, just a love point of view, like a love story, and be like, wow, you know, that was really cool. And I never really thought about all this could hit home really, really fast. So one of the things that I try to remind people about is, you know, look at what the supermarkets and things look like before the hurricanes hit. You know, those cities, most cities are on a 3-day food supply. If disaster hits and you can't get food in there within those 3 days, you have no food left in the city pretty much unless what you have on hand, you know, and now you're going to be fighting with your neighbors for whatever food is left, you know, whereas if you guys just started getting together and really thinking about, you know, oh, we could rent an apartment in our building and we could use that as our storehouse and the community could come together. Our apartment complex could come together. We could all store stuff there. And then if things happen, we'd all have access to the storehouse. I started talking to people in the inner city about this kind of idea. And he looked at me and he said, you know, that is a great idea. But everybody that lives around me is nuts. And I'm like, well, right? I mean, well, that doesn't work at all. Like, so, you know, we have to get out of our computers, right? We have to get out of our computers. We have to get back into the community. So one of the efforts that we have around my house is we have an actual fire safe board because we're in such a high wildfire area. You know, there's these vacant properties and things like that that nobody's maintaining. So the community actually gets together to go out and do maintenance on these properties just because in the long run, it helps us all because now it's not a giant fire risk. So it just starts small and you just have to start planting the seeds.
Well, and I think
well, and
those,
to your point,
I think those things actually,
Jimmy.
Sarah, will are the types of things we see in successful communities and resilient communities is where the communities are working together in other initiatives so that when things strike, neighbors come to help neighbors. And we saw this to a certain extent in Houston when the flooding was going on there.
Yep.
I think we've seen it in places in Florida. We saw it in Puerto Rico. It's still ongoing there. You know, there's communities there that, you know, the bridge got washed out and they rigged cable lines across the river so that people could get back and forth safely across the river without, you know, without having the risk getting swept away. But that community took care of its own problem. And that's an example of people pulling together to get the solutions they need to whatever the problem at hand is.
Right. And those kinds of stories are like what gives me hope, you know, because you look at my books and you're like, wow, you know, we got these crazy people that just decided to go crazy. And sure, there would be a good population, you know, that would try and take advantage of that situation to do the wrong thing. But I've got to believe that the majority of our population would bond together to do the right thing.
But to that point, you know, talking about electronic medias and sitting behind a computer and all of that, how many people really know their neighbors, you know,
yeah,
as opposed to the 60s or 70s when kids were actually out playing rather than sitting in front of a computer? I mean, I'll
exactly
admit, of course, I'm way out in the country, so there aren't too many neighbors to meet, but you know,
but it almost seems like it almost seems like out in
the,
yeah, it almost seems like out in the country, people do know each other better than in the city because you're just another person walking along the road. You know, I don't know if that's true because I haven't lived in the city a whole lot, but you know, I know all my neighbors, I know them pretty well, and so you know, it's like it just takes an effort to stop by and go, hey, what's going on? You know, oh, I saw my neighbor was home from work. You know, I wonder if he's sick. I should stop by and see if he needs some soup or something like that.
Yeah, that's pathetic. There's some muffins. Are they poisoned? No.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know,
right.
You live in, you know, people kind of think that's a little weird. But Joe, what about a big city like Memphis? Can you see that? Do you see that kind of thing happening? I mean, are people, I don't live in this any kind of city anymore, but are people just not getting to know each other like they used to?
Well, I think it's a lot harder than it used to be. And, you know, it's to some extent sort of the nature of our society currently, which is unfortunate. But I do think that sort of on a bit more kind of local basis, if you will, that we are a bit more prone to get out and meet our neighbors and do that sort of stuff. It's just that it's a lot more localized, you know, so it's just going to be the folks that are right in your neighborhood or in your building or something like that. But it certainly takes effort, and you know, but I think that's part of what adds resiliency to a community, and part of the reason it's so important, so that we have, you know, the ability to take care of ourselves when something bad happens.
Well, Jamie, conversely, you live in a very rural community. You've been there for a long time, so I would expect that you folks in your community know each other well. And to that end, you also have people with different talents. You know, you have volunteer fire guys and medical people.
Yeah, we've seen it here before. And, you know, when was it 5-6 years ago, we had the Snowmageddon blizzard that we got 4 feet of snow, and it just completely locked us in for probably 4 or 5 days in our neighborhood, and even the major highways were having trouble getting plowed out. But what happened was, you know, I live in a rural area where half the people have some kind of tractor with a plow on it or a bucket loader. You know, one guy in our neighborhood of about 15 homes has a small tractor with a front end loader on it. So he actually dug a lane for our entire street out to the main road. And met somebody else who was coming up from that road to dig that road out. And they started working together. So the plows could get to us. So we got to the plows, after being snowed in for a couple of days. And that's, you know, that we know everybody here. And I think that's kind of what, like Sarah says, is I live in the country, but everybody knows everybody. And if you don't know the person, you know someone they know. And so there's a connection. And we tend to help each other out. And I'm with Sarah. I think that there'll be people always to take advantage of these situations. But I think by and large, the larger community as a whole will band together and try to maintain the civil society for the greater good. And, you know, you have to believe that. So I like that our stories, that your stories, Sarah, are focusing on that sort of an approach and how people can learn these lessons and be better prepared.
Right. Yeah. And my second book, Without Land, even though it is my ode to big government, you know, on what can happen if we just give government control of everything, it also explains why, though. Like, why? How did it happen? You know, because we needed it. The country needed the help. We needed to organize again. You know, we needed to get food supply back online. We needed to have clothing production, all these things back online. And the only way to do that was from a central structure. So even though, you know, sometimes I will say, oh, it's my old big government, but it explains why. It's not left or right thinking. It's just, you know, this is what happened. This was the response. And this is how, like, different people got swept up in that system.
So, Sarah, we're going to wrap up here pretty quickly, but, you know, what are kind of your main bullet points that you mentioned some of them, but that you're trying to communicate through your books to people in terms of disaster preparedness?
First of all, think about it, you know, because the more you think about it, the more you're going to go, okay, I need water, I need food, I need to get my basics online. And then secondly, how can I help my neighbors? How can I make sure that, you know, they're going to be ready to go too? Because, you know, the more people you can help, the less people you're going to have at your door. Because everybody goes, well, you're prepared. I'm going to come to your house. Well, that's great. But, you know, what are you bringing with you, kind of thing, you know? So you need to have your community. You need to be prepared there. And then the third thing is, so we get swept away a lot of time, like, you know, in all our technological advancements. And that's great. Technology can do wonderful things for us. It has done wonderful things for us. But we need to remember where we came from and remember some of those skills so that if the time ever come when we needed them, we could rapidly put them back into use and, you know, efficiently take care of our people.
Well, and it, like we were saying, it makes sense to share different people's experience and talents and education. So, but that wouldn't work as well if you didn't ever train together or educate each other. Maybe, you know, one person can teach first aid to the rest of them, and then you got the guy with the snowplow, and then you got another guy. You know, whatever it is, right. If you know people's talents ahead of time and you share some of those, that to me really would pull a community together, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do that, you know, me and some of my friends, we do that basically every other Saturday. We get together and do a survival lesson and play airsoft and things like that. We make it fun too. But it's a great way to just make sure we keep coming together. We keep talking about it. We stay fresh with what we're, you know, supplying, what we're investing in this month, you know, where we're going, what we're teaching. Because the basics, you know, a lot of people just don't even know how to clean their water if something were to happen. And now you're just going to be having, you know, all kinds of problems with diarrhea and stuff. And that's not the time you want to be learning how to clean water. You need to know how to do that ahead of time.
Oh, hell no.
Right? Exactly.
Absolutely. You know, Joe, I mean, we talk about training and education and things like that all the time on the show. And while that type of, you know, earth-shattering disaster is not something we prepare for all the time, certainly having communities and organizations that support communities better prepared to help their communities respond to even smaller disasters is important. And that's one of the things the Paragon Medical Education Group does such a great job of. You guys tend to bring customized experiential solutions to whatever that community's disaster of choice is, given their location and what they're predisposed to deal with.
Well, thanks, Jamie. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's any preparing for a disaster on the scale we were just talking about, but obviously, these events can be huge, and preparation is clearly the key. So, we would certainly love to talk to anybody that has any interest and ask them to come find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook by the same name, or you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
Yeah, and it's important to note that, you know, even though we were talking about these, you know, these earth-wide disasters, these worldwide situations, when a disaster strikes you and your community, it feels like the whole world has caved in. And you know, that goes for the responders as well as the individuals that are just living in that community. So it's important to be prepared, and I urge everybody out there checking out the show to check in with Paragon Medical Education Group and Joe and Jim and the rest of the team over there and find out how they can bring some pretty amazing educational material to your community and help you be better prepared. And thanks again, Joe, for supporting the show.
Thank you, Jamie.
So Sarah, where can folks find you and find your books and find out more information about maybe your podcast and some other things?
Yep. They can find me over at www.authorsarahfhathaway.com. It's author Sarah is S-A-R-A, F like Frank, Hathaway.com. And you're going to find my books there, my audio books there, the podcast. I do a chapter of my book and then we explore a topic from the chapter. So it's always a lot of fun. You're getting the facts and the fiction together. And that's all there. My website is just kind of my main hub. So if you want to find me on Facebook, Twitter, any of those things, just head on over to my website and you can contact me directly there as well.
And I'm looking at it right this instant, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes for this episode over at disasterpodcast.com. So hopefully folks will head over there and contact you and get in touch with you.
That'd be great.
And Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, in the usual social media places, under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on our Facebook page. And also on disasterpodcast.com. And I'll throw this out for Kyle, since he wasn't here with us tonight, WX Kyle Nelson, pretty easy, in all the social media places. And he's hanging around the Facebook site quite a bit. So as he would say, come by and continue the conversation. What about you, Jamie?
Well, I can be found under the handle PodMedic in most social media places out there. And, of course, over at our Disaster Podcast Facebook group, which I urge everybody to go and check out. Just search for Disaster Podcast. You'll find our Facebook group. Just request to join. We'd love to have you over there. We've got well over 500 people in the group right now, and we post episodes as they come available, and you can ask questions, and hopefully maybe we can get Sarah in there too, and she can contribute as well, and we can get an opportunity for people to talk about all kinds of situations that might present themselves, large and small. So it's been a good episode, Sam. And you know, even though, like I said, even though we were talking about a worldwide disaster situation and an apocalyptic scale, it really is true. And I talk about this when we educate people. I know you do as well, Sam, that, you know, it may not feel like an emergency to us, but to the people we're responding to, it's their emergency. And that's true whether it's a tornado that struck three houses in a neighborhood. For those people, it's devastating. Or if it's a hurricane that's wiped out half a state, it's devastating. And we need to remember that.
Well, and that makes a good point. And if you think about it, if you're really prepared or as much as you can be for something that big, you're certainly going to be able to handle things better that are smaller and actually more realistic. So just another good example of disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.